everyone. Welcome to the 88th episode of the Atlas Society Asks. My name is Abby Beringer. I'm the student program manager for the Atlas Society. We're the leading nonprofit organization introducing young people to the ideas of Ayn Rand in creative ways through our animated videos, graphic novels, and Atlas University seminars with these two wonderful gentlemen that we have here with us today. Today, we'll be discussing current events with Richard Salzman and Stephen Hicks, two of our Atlas Society senior scholars. We will also save time at the end to take some audience questions. So at the, if you want to post those questions into the chat on Zoom, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, wherever you're at, post them as we go and we will answer some of your questions. With that, thank you for joining us. And let's get started with our first topic. I will hand things over to Dr. Hicks. We're going to talk free speech in universities. Dr. Hicks, I cede the floor to you.
Okay, thanks, Abby. Good to see you again, Richard. And
good to see you.
Hopefully it'll be a fun hour. So perennial issue, free speech, but then a piece of journalism in the New York Times that's pointing up an interesting angle on the free speech debates. We have the classical arguments for censorship or for free speech, academic freedom, and so on. But one of the issues that seems to be driving the current iteration of authoritarianism, speech codes, and then also in some cases mandated speech, it's not just that you can't say certain things, but rather you're forced to say certain other things, is an interesting gender imbalance. So the recent survey that was done, I think Lawrence or Abby will be putting this in the chat if you want to check out the link as well, saying that almost by a 2-to-1 margin, younger women are more likely to favor speech codes, that is to say banning certain words and mandating the use of certain other words compared to young men who are in universities. And that's kind of striking. So the numbers were, look over here at my notes here, that male students preferred free speech by a 61% margin to 39%. And then female students took the opposite position, being willing to overturn free speech in order to achieve certain social goals by 64 to 35. That's an interesting question about why that is the case. Now, my question as a philosopher is why it's not anymore the case that 95% of students are saying we want free speech and only 5% are saying, no, we are going to be authoritarian for various sorts of reasons. And that, I think, is an important question because 40 years ago, when I was a younger person, that was about what the demographics were. So there is a very interesting intellectual history question, a very interesting institutional shift question about why we've gone from basically everybody signing on to some sort of free speech and academic freedom to one of the genders that's down to 60-something%. And that's very significant. So the intellectual history is important. The intellectual capture is important. One other issue that's arising in the literature, the debates over this is people wanting to argue whether we need to add, say, an evolutionary psychology component to this. That's one thing to make the arguments abstractly for intellectual freedom. To tailor those to universities and argue for free speech, for the absence of speech codes or so on. But whether in addition to that, there are some subtle psychological differences between males and females that lead people to be more interested and willing to engage in the somewhat combative nature of free for all arguments in a higher education context versus those more likely to be nurturing and inclusive and so on. And I think that's interesting, worth exploring, but outside of my area of expertise. I don't put a huge amount of credence to that because for many generations we know men and women, despite whatever their predispositions are psychologically, are able to understand the importance to free speech in intellectual matters, the need to speak for oneself, the principles of tolerance. So I think the more important issue is not that there's been some evolutionary button that's now being pushed that wasn't being pushed before significantly, but rather it's been a matter of a couple of generations now of training to devalue freedom, particularly intellectual freedom, and that's what we are seeing. Another interesting issue about how this is going to play out over the course of the next generation or so is there's another important demographic number in higher education, and that is that younger men are starting university at a lower rate than young men did start university in previous generations in the 20th century. And younger women are starting university at higher rates. And so standard freshman classes, the national average is that it's about 60% young women and about 40% young men. And also then if you track the dropout rate or the attrition rate after a year, younger men are dropping out of university at higher rates than younger women are. So all of this then is interesting in terms of the demographics of universities over the next 10 years and then how that demographics is going to play out in terms of academic freedom issues in the next 10 years. Do we try to reform the universities? Do we at some point give up on certain universities and build parallel institutions? All of those practical issues follows as well. So, discussion piece.
Abby, do I have a moment to comment on this great stuff?
Yes, you do.
Or you want to just go to, we can go to questions if you want.
Go ahead if you have a, you know, do anything you want to add. Okay.
I have a couple of things. It's a fascinating topic. It's a great survey to uncover. I think it's a survey from 2016. Nevertheless, the New York Times felt the need to focus on it now. The title itself interested me. The gender gap is taking us to unexpected places. You read through the essay, it's not clear where that unexpected place is and who's the who's not expecting this. But the other thing I noticed, you know, the standard, Professor Hicks, you know this, the kind of standard view these days is there's no difference between the genders. You know, that maybe that's a biological, physiological point, but here the essay is clearly about ideological or other differences. I was struck by not so much the survey, but these academics like Dennis Chung from USC and Steven Pinker from Harvard, Pinker, who I admire very much, their interpretations of the survey. And the interpretations are very conventional. They're almost like stereotypical. So here's a quote from Chung. Chung is from USC, he's a political scientist. Chung says, quote, he found broad value differences between men and women. Women score higher on values defined by care, fairness, benevolence, and protecting the welfare of others, and reflecting greater empathy and preference for cooperative relations instead of competitive. In today's debates over free speech and cancel culture, these social, psychological, and value differences between men and women are in line with surveys showing, now get this now, that women are more likely than men to regard hate speech as a form of violence, unquote. It just struck me as, think of the conflict. You know, they're really more caring and benevolent and compassionate, but they want to strike down your right to speak. They interpret speech as violence. Now, I'm not sure this is broadly true, but it's almost like the writers didn't catch the conflict or the irony. Now, Pinker from the Better Angels of Our Nature, quote, violence, great book on violence, by the way, the decline of violence over time, quote, but he says, violence mainly committed by men. From the time they're boys, males play with more violently than females. They fantasize more about violence. They consume more violent entertainment. They commit the lion's share of violence, okay, on and on. And yet they seem a bit more liberal, tolerant, toward speech. I mean, that's a big test, right? Speech. It's not really violence. What's their view of it? So I kind of leave it at that. I think it's also interesting that if the issue is, what is this going to do for our speech rights, but maybe also our politics? I just want to bring to your attention something I found out about 10 years ago, and it was really fascinating. I was conducting a seminar on growth in the last century about the size and scope of government. And we went through various theories of what might be causing this. And one of the theories uncovered, believe it or not, is the women's right to vote. So in America, the women's right to vote at the national level was what, 1920. they did have the right to vote at various states like New Jersey much earlier than that. But there's actually in the political science literature, without trying to be sexist, poli-sci people who looked at and correlated the rise of the progressive era and the welfare state and the expansion of government, including the expansion of government in a warlike fashion, to more women voting. So I only bring this up because I thought of that when I saw this. If this survey is telling us that despite their predilections allegedly for care, fairness, benevolence, cooperation, that there might be contributing to an illiberal politics, that is in the past literature in terms of, if you think of the expansive and redistributive welfare state as initiating force. This was a great coverage. I really like it, Professor Hicks.
Yeah, thanks. One other point I wanted to just throw in is the survey couched things in terms of a dichotomy. Are you in favor of free speech or are you in favor of inclusiveness?
Right. Now, that's
a false dichotomy. There should be harmonious values. That you know, what we want inclusively is for everybody to be able to participate in the debate so that they can define their own beliefs, define their own values. And the only way that can happen is through free speech. But there is a rather subversive and kind of dehumanizing assumption built into casting it as a dichotomy. So the idea then is that certain target groups that we need to include, the assumption then is if we have free speech, they're not going to be get included, right? That they don't have the ability to step up and speak in their own voice and make their own arguments. And that the only way we can kind of give them a seat at the table, so to speak, and notice that paternalistic formulation, we need to give them a seat at the table so that they feel safe and included, is by kind of hobbling other people and restricting other people's rights. So there is that subversive and paternalistic dichotomy based on a false opposition. So that's worth flagging.
I also noticed the stereotype of embedded in this, you know, in the interpretation, you know, women are more prone to feeling, they're more sensitive to feelings and sentiments and emotions. But then now it's very well documented that in the case of speech that's critical, speech that's aggressive, speech, not actions, the idea that I feel offended, I feel triggered, I feel all of these things we've heard over the recent years, the transformation of feeling anxiety translated into you're harming me, you're actually creating a physiological reaction in me, and that's violence. Again, it seems stereotypical, but the article doesn't pick up on that. It's not eager to say, these seem like really old-fashioned stereotypes of women, but not just that, but therefore exonerating them from really kind of illiberal leanings.
Yeah.
It's just something I noticed.
For sure.
Well, we do have one question now, and it's going to have to call back something to memory here. So you'll have to tell us if you remember this. James Donegal on Facebook wants to know, how do you think this topic relates to the 2019 Super Bowl commercial done by Gillette? I don't know if you guys remember that commercial that put down traditionally boyhood activities such as roughhousing. So how does that this topic relate to something like that?
I have vague memories of that Gillette commercial, and I think I have a softer interpretation of it. When I looked at it, what I saw primarily was a call for men to be men in the best sense, not to be chauvinist, not to be priggish, and not to think that being masculine meant that you had to be overbearing and so on. So to check men who were overstepping the line. But at the same time, if it's the same commercial we're talking about, I do know several people who were conservative who saw it as admonishing men for normal, healthy masculinity. But I don't know. maybe I've been too desensitized by my university climate. I didn't see that, but I'm open to argument that saying that maybe in some subtle way, there is some of that in there.
Personally, I do remember that also. And the fact that, Abby, the fact that it occurred in the Super Bowl, even going even further back, and I'm going to challenge James. It's like, James, do you remember that in earlier years, women's groups, feminists, took the opportunity to say that Super Bowl day is when men are like most violent. They're watching this violent game, they're drinking beer, and they're beating up their women. I mean, that was a very common theme, and they allegedly had data for this. And so it seemed to take on an importance of, this is the Super Bowl, and millions are watching. So let's try to get in on the messaging. And I do remember that in 2019. Now, Gillette was critical, you know, Gillette always had commercials about obviously shaving and, you know, it's manly, blah, blah, blah. And I do think it was possibly the beginnings of corporate woke. I think it was the beginnings of corporate woke, maybe not the first and only case, but Gillette being mostly a man's product company, personal products company. It could be like the beginnings of woke. And remember also the term at the time, not as common today, toxic masculinity. You never hear about toxic femininity, but the phrase of toxic masculinity, something about men poisoning the environment or poisoning men-women relations were very common. And I'm wondering whether Gillette was pushing back against that as well. But
yeah,
talk about integrating. James is listening to us today, Stephen, and saying, hey, what about that Gillette commercial?
Nice.
That's a nice attempt to integrate the two topics.
Well, Abby, if I could segue to a question in the chat from Graham Wood. It's on a similar evolutionary psychology premise. But what I would like to say is I'm open to all of these evolutionary psychology arguments that there are biological and physiological differences that give rise at various developmental stages to psychological differences in personality and emotion. I don't want to pronounce on that. But as a philosopher, I want to say also that that should not be relevant to moral principles and political principles. If it's the case that some human beings are more quick to anger and other human beings are less quick to anger, or if some human beings are more likely to have whatever chemical is secreted when we are afraid than other human beings, it doesn't change the fact that courage in that particular case is a necessary virtue for all human beings. All it will mean is at the individual level, some people will need to work a little harder to develop their courage, and other people will need it to work a little less hard in order to develop their courage. So the principles of virtues and the principles of values, including political virtues and political values, should remain the same. And it's still not going to be very difficult for people to recognize as rational human beings, right, what those principles are, why those principles are important, then to come to know themselves as unique individuals, and then customize, right, whatever it is. You know, just to make a physiological example, it might be the case that some people, when they taste sugar on their tongues, get, you know, 100 units of pleasure coursing through their veins, and other people only get 60 units of pleasure coursing through their veins. The principles of nutrition and developing good habits of eating are still going to be the same for all human beings, just customized, right, and so on. So if we then cast that in terms of maybe there are differences between men and women physiologically and psychologically, and I put the word maybe in there because I just want to leave that as an open debate, that's not going to change the nature of the ethical arguments. Now, Graham's question, or Graham Wood's question, is interesting here, and I want to question whether it's true. It's in case not everyone is there. Could you talk about the fact that men push more for individual liberty, but also integrate their aggressiveness into their beings? In contrast, women are not as aggressive, but easily put down individual liberty, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not so sure that that's true, because I think, at least the women I know, if you raise issues of individual liberty with respect to religion, or individual liberty with respect to their sex lives, or individual liberty with respect to the abortion issue. My experience is that women are much more aggressive with respect to defending individual liberty than the men that I know. So there might be some domain differences, and I think we would need to get better data on that. So I'm not sure that this dichotomy is quite true as Mr. Wood is putting it forth here. So I'll just leave it at that.
If I were to pose a question to Professor Hicks, if it were true that, say, over the next decade, these kind of stereotypes were, we push back against these kind of stereotypes, and women were taught that you too are human, your essence too is rationality, rational egoism, whatever, all the whole, would this get, quote, so-called gap narrow? In other words, is this gap due to the kind of things feminists don't want to hear about? We precondition women to, you know, play with dolls, not G.I. Joe, to be caring and feeling, not blah, blah, blah. And that very issue, that very training is causing the gap. I don't know.
I think it's 99% driven by training, in my view.
And someone like Jonathan Haidt is basically saying, no, it's great psychologists up at NYU, but Jonathan leans more in the direction of the evolutionary psychology, right?
That right. This is kind of built my in. Reading of Haidt is that he's going back to an old kind of moral sentiments position of the 1700s and giving a priority to, obviously we're not calling them moral sentiments anymore, but the updated psychological terms for the priority of the non-rational over the rational.
Interesting. I hope it's interesting.
All right. Well, let's for now, we'll move on to our next topic. We have a few more questions we can answer at the end, potentially on this note. All right. Topic number two, inflation is at 7% right now. Why and what's next? And I think we'll hand this off to our resident economist, Richard, to start.
Okay. Why and what's next? Okay. Inflation is the kind of word where when you say it, people's eyes glaze over. And they say, especially you philosophers, Dr. Hick, stop it. Stop torturing me with these inflation words. Okay, here's why it's important.
No, I'm all ears.
You are not. I know you're not.
Teach me.
Are you? Okay. First of all, what the heck is it? Inflation is a decline in the value of money. I'm really proud of that, actually, because most economists won't be that succinct. Let me repeat. Inflation is a decline in the value of money. So what's the value of money? What it can actually buy at the store, the stuff you end up with, you know, when you at the checkout counter, how much food, how much goods. Why would it shrink just because there's something wrong with the money? That alone, by the way, is a controversial view. And I'm going to give the other view, but first I'm going to give the true view. But so that's the thing. It starts with money. It's a decline in the value of money. But that's too abstract for people. So I'm going to just say the purchasing power of money, that's actually too abstract. So I'm going to say what you can buy at the grocery store. Now, what causes it? The government is basically in charge of monetary creation. Under the gold standard, the private sector is. But we've long passed the gold standard. We're 50 years past the gold standard. So point two is, if inflation is a decline in the value of money, the point two is government caused a decline in the value of money, the money it issues, dollars, euros, yen. Now, why? Why would the value of the money they issue go down? Okay, now this is basically supply demand stuff. If I said to you, ignore money for a moment. If I said to you, a bunch of apples were supplied, a bumper crop of apples were supplied and nobody really demanded more apples, what would you say the value of apples would do? Go down, decline, and a surplus of apples, right? The same thing is true of money. If a government issues too much money, what does that even mean? People want money, right? Now, the issue here is not their income. The issue is how much money do you hold in your pocket, in your bank account? Really abstract, but that's the issue. And when government issues too much money, relative to how much money you want to hold, it causes the value of money to decline. It shows up in higher prices. So the prices are a derivative. They're an outcome. They're basically the messenger saying, hello, the value of money is lower, meaning you have to give me more pieces of that thing to get your loaf of bread. That's why prices go up. Prices going up amounts to saying, why do I have to give more dollars to get the same loaf of bread? Answer, because each dollar is worth less. Not worthless, worth less. Get the idea? Now the next level. See how abstract? This is really abstract stuff, and it leads to real, you need really strong epistemology to get this. Okay, then the third question would be, why would the government issue too much money? So the first point was, too much money causes inflation. Second, government's doing it, government, not anybody else. Third, why would they do this? If the cost of living is going up, isn't this a bad thing for a government official to admit? Answer to that, imagine this now. If the government wants to spend a lot of money, which it does, and doesn't want to tax you, why? Because they'd lose elections. One alternative is just to print the difference. See the difference? You can raise money by taxing people, taking some of their wealth and saying, that's how we will finance the spending. But an alternative would be, and a very common alternative for a politician would be, I wonder if we can do this with no one noticing that we taxed them. We can create money. And that's kind of like a hidden tax. Okay, now I'm going to flip to, what do people think of inflation? They go to the grocery store. Prices are much higher than they were last month. My God, the grocer is exploiting me. What is wrong with this grocer? This is what's ingenious about inflation. You blame the messenger. You blame the price setters. The price setters don't even know. Like, you go to Whole Foods and they're like, okay, a loaf of bread is now $3, not $2. They don't know the government did that. But you notice that the price is higher. You get angry at Whole Foods. This is what's happening now. If you see discussions of inflation, notice you will not really hear what I just told you. You'll hear things like, the price of meat is up 26%. The price of food is up, blah, blah, blah. The price of gas is up. And in each case, the implication is the following. The gas sellers, the bread sellers are villainous. What are they doing? And I'm going to talk tomorrow, if you guys want to join in. I have a clubhouse tomorrow on whether price controls are possible and likely. The price controls are a very dangerous answer, a bad answer to inflation. In other words, instead of stopping the excess money creation, what if government steps up and says, we're going to save the day. We're going to prevent people like grocers from raising prices. We're going to prevent gas sellers, and we're going to be heroes here, because then you can afford it. Price controls are government interventions that ultimately lead to shortages. I'll go through that more tomorrow. But my bottom line on this whole topic would be, inflation is going up. By the way, contextually, it's going up at the fastest rate in 40 years. This is no just blip. The 40 years means 1982. It's a long time ago. So 7% is very high. Could it go to 10 or 11? Yes, it could, because so much money has been created. And so it's a real danger. But I think the secondary danger is price controls, because this is basically blaming the messenger and saying, well, inflation must be a bunch of people raising prices. Notice it's the effect, not the cause. So it's going after the effect, not the cause, but it's specifically targeting price setters, not the causers of inflation like the Federal Reserve.
Can I jump in, Richard?
Go right ahead.
I have a longer comment I want to make, but right now it's a clarification question.
Yeah.
So prices can go up partly for inflationary reasons, but also prices can go up because there are restrictions on supply.
Yes.
And so the question is, in the current mess, we know we're coming out of huge supply chain disruptions due to COVID, yes, and various, yeah, other things.
Yeah.
Are we able to tease out what percentage, say, of the inflation, inflation is not the right word there, the rising prices is due to disruptions on the supply side, and what amount of it is coming from selling T-bonds for 20 years down the road with no idea how we're going to pay for them.
So the ultimate answer to your question is, can we tease out the different? The answer is yes. The answer is yes, actually. And it's really, it's not easy, but, and the answer is important because absolutely right. If there's a crop failure, forget inflation and monetary, suppose there's just a crop failure, it's just a bad crop, and the price of corn goes up. That, I would say, is not inflation. Right. And in economists, you know, Stephen, economists will say that's just a microeconomic phenomenon, meaning unique to that industry, unique to that product. That's what micro means in economics. When we speak of macroeconomic, macro meaning the entire picture, inflation is a macro phenomenon, and therefore a phenomenon associated with the money supply growing faster than demand. And you can tease that out. And but what I'm saying is that is not what politicians tend to do. Because imagine this: if Joe Biden got up and said, "I'm really sorry the cost of living is going up," which is what inflation is. I'm really sorry that the cost of living is going up, but the Federal Reserve has been creating a lot of money. And by the way, they were creating a lot of money under Trump as well. So there's this delayed effect. And we're going to try to stop that. And we feel really bad about it. And we've misbehaved. They would never say that. Instead, they get up and say, they actually said this. I am embarrassed even to repeat it. Jen Psaki got up and said, meat prices are going up 26%. The problem is big meat. She actually said, Stephen, if I said to you, you know, half of it is monetary inflation, you know, and half of it is supply chain problems, or the economic lockdown prevented people from going into meat plants. That's actually what's happened. They can't get workers. It is a combination of the two, but the political reaction usually is isolate and criticize those who set the prices. Why? Because it takes the focus off of us, the causal part of it, and puts it on the effect. And that's, by the way, why price controls become plausible to people. They look out and they say, well, the problem here is people who are setting meat prices. Those are actually meat producers. Slap down what they're doing. I'll leave it at that, but it's a, I think inflation is one of the more complicated economic phenomena, in part because it's monetary, and anything monetary itself is abstract. But then when you layer in the government's involvement in money and the reasons why it might create too much of it, it is one of the most difficult things for people to get their head around.
Yeah. I'm gonna jump in as a moralist and talk about the morality, or actually what I think of as the immorality of inflation.
Yeah.
My understanding of the economic story is as you've laid it out.
Yeah.
And the way I think of inflation is as a kind of a tax on future productivity.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is saying we're going to print more money, and sometimes they do print more money, but typically what they do is they sell bonds.
Yeah.
Right. And the bonds then are going to come due 10 years, 20 years down the road.
Yeah.
And then we know that the American economy will be productive 10 or 20 years down the road. And then we'll have the tax revenues to roll over the bonds for the next generation. So that's all the economics of it. But it does strike me that despite all of the abstraction, people do understand, particularly politicians, do understand money enough to know that they are functioning as immoral individuals. In the following sense, if you strip it down to this is a form of debt that you're planning to pay off in the future.
Yeah.
And we all understand the idea that if you take on debt with no clue how you are going to pay that debt off in the future, that you are acting in a profoundly irresponsible fashion. If I happen to have a credit card and I can charge up $20,000, but I know I have no income prospects, if I spend that $10,000, I am functioning as an immoral individual. So I would say any politician who is voting for multi-billion, trillion-dollar bills, say, yeah, I want these goodies politically right now, and I have no idea how this is going to be paid for 10 years or 15 years down the road. That is an immoral individual. Another element that I think is inappropriate, doubly inappropriate here is, you know, if I think, okay, I'm going to borrow some money, and money in effect is analogous to an IOU, right? It's going to be a claim on something, right, in the future. So I start issuing IOUs to people, yeah. Setting aside the issue of whether I know I can make good on those IOUs or not in the good. If in that IOU contract, I put a specification that if I don't happen to pay this off, don't worry, my kids, I'm contractually binding my kids to paying this debt off to you.
Yeah.
That is an additional, right, immorality. And we know that all of the politicians, they have to understand budgeting and money, at least to the point that they know it's their kids and their grandkids who are supposed to be paying for this, but nonetheless, they're taking the short-term political gains and saddling other people with the debt. So we all understand this as an immorality at the individual level, but for some reason, there's a double standard. We're willing to say, oh, it's just politicians, blah, blah, blah. We know what they are doing. So I think that double standard, that moral double standard, is something we need to highlight. Yes, we do need better economic education, but we need to hold politicians' moral feet to the fire on these sorts of issues.
I like that, and I like the idea that the voters themselves must know what they're voting for. Because if a politician stands up and says, goodies, 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 spending, 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 most Americans still commonsensically say, how are you going to pay for that? The only options are tax, borrow, print. And one of the reasons I love Stephen Hicks is, how can a philosopher know so much about economics? My gosh. And not just that, he knows so much about public finance. Because that's what objectivists do. They have like a well-rounded knowledge.
We could ask how an economist knows so much about philosophy, Richard.
and let me just add, one of the most fascinating things you said, which I didn't say, because I thought this is way over their heads, but you said it. If the government borrows a lot of money, it's got to pay the money back in the future, right? What is inflation? A decline in the value of money. How immoral is that? These are people who borrow knowing darn well that the value of the money they pay at the end is lower. Wow. And they know this. And the Federal Reserve knows it, and all the specialists know it. And they don't mind it. So think of this also. It isn't just an issue of, they issue too much money and then blame the grocer or blame the gas pump. They also know that they're piling up a massive amount of government debt. Oh my God, they're thinking, oh my gosh, how do we pay that back? We're never gonna pay that back because we'd have to tax people. But if we print money, the value of what we have to pay back is lower. We're basically going to immorally debase lower the value of money we pay back to people. Wow. Now that is way more abstract, because now you're talking about inflation and debt, but that is definitely a factor. I'm glad you mentioned it. It's a good one. Thank you.
All right, well, we have quite a few questions if you guys are ready to move on to some questions.
Oh no, inflation questions?
Yes, but we'll start with Jennifer Grossman wants to know, should the government raise interest rates and why? Or why not? And what will be the pros and cons of that policy?
Well, thank you, Jennifer. I am very reluctant to say, hey, the government should do this or that with some market price. I hate that. I hate the whole thing. On the other hand, I'm inclined to say, yes, why? Because when they artificially keep interest rates at zero, that is just so wrong, unnatural, in a way immoral. An interest rate is a reward to lending. Right? So they're punishing lenders by trying to depress interest rates. Why are they trying to punish lenders? Lenders are dastardly, capitalistic, greedy. See, that they're always on the side of the borrowers. Hey, dear borrower, wouldn't it be nice to borrow at zero? Please vote for us. Now, who's the biggest borrower? The government. So it's very clever because the Federal Reserve, oh, we should keep interest rates at zero. Why? Oh, when I'm trying to stimulate the economy. Really? Stimulate the economy? No, to provide low-cost funding for the economy's borrowers and to penalize the economy's lenders. is total altruism as applied to public finance? But that's a good question, Jennifer. So I'm reluctant to say to some central planner, please raise the price of something, but they should because it's really artificially low. So my answer is yes, they should raise interest rates.
That's interesting, Dr. Salzman. I remember the first time you said that on Morals and Markets about why the government wants to keep interest rates at zero. I had never heard that. So much for my Econ 102 public university.
No, you're fine, Abby.
No, that's very interesting. I don't think a lot of people think about that. So next question from Jack Buspis on YouTube. What is the solution to modern day inflation? Would the solution cause illiquidity in the financial markets?
The answer is no, it wouldn't cause illiquidity. The solution is to basically anchor, I think that's a good analogy, anchor the money in some objective commodity. Hint, hint, gold. So this is a huge topic, but I'll just come out for the gold standard. But, you know, libertarians will sometimes say, hey, Salzman, why don't you just come out for free choice in money? And it might end up being the gold standard, but it might end up being Bitcoin. I have no problem with that. I think the key thing is to get government out of the money business. I mean, the creation and manipulation of money and credit. But I have to say, and I've written on this at length, the main reason we have central banks issuing money without limit, the reason is we have a welfare state which is out of control and politicians who smartly do not want to tax people. And so they don't. But that means you have to resort to other methods of funding this crazy spending. And one of the big ones is printing money. But one of the other ones, as Dr. Hicks has pointed out, is borrowing money. In neither case, though, are they really issuing debt or money that's credible. Why is it not credible? Because it's not backed by any productive prowess. When a company borrows money, you know, like if Microsoft borrows money, it's got a product, it's got revenues that are productive, and it, you know, turns around and repays the bank. The government is not fundamentally a productive enterprise. So if it borrows, it's basically acting in some parasitical way on the productive sector. It's not sustainable. They're either going to have to default on it, literally stop paying principal and interest, or as Dr. Hicks pointed out, no, they just print money and they don't technically default, but the money you get from them when you buy their bonds is worth substantially less at the end, which is a kind of default. So inflation itself is a kind of default. I hope that helps.
I wonder though, if I sometimes wonder about who buys these bonds knowing they're coming due in 5 years or 10 years. And these are going to be very financially savvy people running major institutions and so on.
Right.
And so they're not going to buy these bonds unless they're pretty sure that they the interest on them and the principal is going to be repaid. So they are making a calculation, having normalized the idea that governments can tax their citizens at whatever rate is necessary. And or borrow in the future. But the other calculation they're making is about the state of the U.S. economy as a whole, that it's going to grow at 2% or 3%. So the productivity is out there. Tax revenues are going to be higher. We can adjust the tax revenues and so on. So it's still a safe investment. What do you think about that kind of calculation?
That's a great question. Also, most philosophers don't ask questions like that. That's a great question. And my short answer would be, they are conscious of the power of the government to borrow almost without limit. And one of the weirdest things about the United States is it's borrowing a lot and creating a lot of dollars, but relative to other countries, it's still considered a responsible government. If you look at it in isolation, it looks irresponsible relative to longtime U.S. history. But what these very astute traders on Wall Street and elsewhere do, Stephen, is they look at, well, what about government debt, U.S. government debt relative to German government debt, relative to Greek government debt, relative to Canadian. So it's like having, the worst house on the block, or the best house on the U.S. It's a relative thing. All the governments of the world are becoming profligate, irresponsible, as you would put it, immoral, but at varying rates. And some would say the US is less profligate than others. It's very odd, very weird.
Yeah.
But they're still profligate.
Oh, yeah.
We'll do one more question on this topic before we move on to the next. David Kelly here on Zoom wants to know, are there significant differences between inflation in the 1970s and now?
Yes, David, great question. In the 1970s, the reason the inflation was much worse, I believe, and you and I lived through this, you were writing for Barron's at the time, it was much worse. But the US had just gone off the gold standard in 1971. So it was a very chaotic decade. If you've been on the gold standard for 50 years, as the world was and as the US was, and then you go off, it's very difficult for markets to figure out, oh my gosh, where's the dollar going? There's no anchor. It's literally like being a ship at sea and then you cut the anchor. You have to make an estimate of, my God, is this thing going to float off to Asia? Is it going to sink? Is it going to, you know, be buffeted by the storms of blah, 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 blah? And so the uncertainty, I would say, David, in the 1970s of where the dollar was going made people doubt it even more. Now, of course, we're still off the gold standard now, but you have to confess that decades of being off the gold standard, there have been long periods of time when there hasn't been high inflation. And I would say that you would know this. This has surprised some of the Austrian economists, the Ludwig von Mises. I love Mises and others, but for years they've been saying, we're going to have a hyperinflation. Peter Schiff will say that. We're going to have a hyperinflation. It's just around the corner. Why? Because Mises taught them that the longer a currency is off the gold standard, the more likely it's just going to go to zero. It's going to lose all its value. There's going to be a hyperinflation. And that hasn't really been true in the US. And it's a head scratcher to a lot of free market economists. They're thinking, wait a minute, how can a purely fiat money inconvertible, how can it hold its value? I don't mean it doesn't deteriorate, it does. Inflation's like 2 or 3% a year. It's been a surprise to them. But that's my answer as the difference in the 70s. And the question comes up all the time, are we gonna get an inflation like the 70s in the coming decade? Well, that literally that means 15, 20%. A year, not seven. So it's no small thing. I don't think it's likely because, as I said, I think the 70s were unique in it was like a earthquake. We're off the gold standard. Go figure it out. That's not quite where we are today.
All right. Well, for now, we will move on to our third topic, and we will circle back to some of your guys' questions at the end. Third topic here. Pig heart transplants. So, Stephen, I think you're going to kick us off with this very interesting topic.
I'm trying to change my emotional set because the more Richard was talking, the sadder I was becoming about all of the inflation stuff. Now, this struck me. I don't know if Lawrence or you can put the link up there, but there was a report on a successful transplant of a pig heart into a human being who needed a heart transplant. Now, heart transplants in one respect are an amazing achievement in the 20th century, but in a way they are old news. So the cross species transplant is a technical achievement. It's a scientific achievement and a medical achievement. But there's a couple of other interesting things. One is that we've been facing organ shortages across the board chronically. And so this opens up the possibility of a basically limitless supply of organs to get to people who genuinely need these organs and so forth. One of the things, this is another piece of good news that's had a negative lining to it, is one of the reasons why we have an organ shortage is that driving safety has improved so much over the last 20 or 30 years. So instead of having 70,000 car deaths per year, we're down to 30,000 car deaths per year. And that's really good news, right?
Yeah.
Unless you you want an organ transplant.
I never thought of that. Wow, that's great.
Yes, right. So that then has meant that aside from the scientific impetus to try to figure out new knowledge and so forth, but there's been a lot of entrepreneurial activity around how to increase the supply of organs. I just wanted to mention that this is also an achievement in genetic engineering, because it wasn't just take out the pig heart, swap it into the human being. It required that the pig first be genetically modified for various markers so that they are compatible with human beings. So great advances in genetics, in genetic engineering, and then obviously it's going to be a lifesaver for many human beings. Now, following some of the discussion around this, and there are some interesting side angles. Of course, there have been people who are distressed by all of this. The long-standing automatic negative response to any sort of medical achievement, anesthesia, surgery in the first place, et cetera. And even doing transplants has been controversial. Any sort of genetic modification has been controversial. And there's an interesting issue for us to think about. I think about it sometimes is that every time there is some sort of scientific / technical / medical achievement, there does seem to be this huge psychological divide between those whose first reaction is, this is cool, this is great, and they see the upside to it. And they recognize that, yes, there are risks, there are downsides, but their sense is those can be solved, we can handle those right at some point along the way. Yeah. Versus those, every time that innovation comes along and their first reaction is, this is Frankenstein. This is evil scientist. This is Hollywood end of the world scenario. And they're only kind of vaguely aware of the potential upsides and so on. So I'm interested in probing more deeply into what's behind those two sets, the people who always are kind of boomsters with respect to the technology and those who are doomsters with respect to the technology. And the same thing is occurring here. Another interesting angle to this is this question about human identity. So there's a kind of longstanding issues about, we start swapping out organs. I get a liver transplant from somebody, and then I get a kidney transplant, then I get a heart transplant. At what point do I kind of stop being Stephen Hicks and start being this agglomeration of various other individuals whose organs I have in my bodies?
Wouldn't that require a brain transplant?
Well, yes, and then we get to the brain, and then it takes a different variation if you start talking about artificial parts, right? So suppose I have a portable kidney dialysis machine, but I don't have my original kidneys anymore. I have a Jarvik 75 heart, the latest artificial heart, or I have some sort of computer implants taking over various parts of my brain function. Yeah. At stop point, do I stop being a human being and start being an android or a robot? Right. And so there are those fun issues. But an interesting issue that came up in one of the discussions here was people who were more disturbed by the pig heart being transplanted into a human than, say, a Jarvik 7 or a Jarvik 75 being transplanted into a human, that they were more comfortable with the idea of a piece of kind of plastic and silicon technology taking the place of a heart rather than an animal. Right, like a pig taking the place of the heart. And so there are some interesting value issues built into what is it to be a human and what level of comfort a lot of people have. So I put that out there primarily as a good news issue to balance the two negatives, but also just one that raises kind of some fun questions about human identity.
Yeah, and Stephen, did you ever come across the argument that, hey, what are you arrogant humans doing sacrificing pigs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Benefit of it. So just the idea, wait a minute, you have no say. You can't be exploiting pigs.
Yeah, I'm sure the animal rights activists will be jumping all over that as well. Yes.
That's in there as well. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So the question then will be, to ameliorate that problem, whether entirely lab grown pig hearts that are genetically modified is going to be possible.
Yeah. And I often say to students, when it comes to farm animal, pigs, cows, chickens, humans propagate them. So it's hard to think for self-interest reasons. So it's hard to think of humans as exploiting those species when they mass produce them.
Right.
Kind of weird. Yeah. Kind of weird. Yeah.
Well, here's a comment here that leads into a question from Scott Schiff. He says, promoting life extension is the future of a philosophy with life as the standard of good. Do you agree with that, Stephen?
Yes, although the philosopher in me immediately wants to get careful about that. So to say that life is the standard of good is not necessarily to say that life is always good. So we do raise those judgment calls about, you know, if life is the standard of good, then we then detail that as individuals, what goods I'm going to be pursuing and under what circumstances my life is worthwhile. But the default position certainly is, you know, the more the better. And so I'm gung-ho about all of the life extension potentialities that are out there.
Yeah, so am I. So am I. And the whole idea of life extension, whether due to vitamins or other transplants and things like that, if you think of it, capitalism as a system which has enormously extended lifespans, just the system itself has. But Stephen, you know what it reminds me of? Life extension sounds like years, sounds like quantity, and doesn't necessarily get to the issue of quality.
Right.
So if you had an extension of the quality of life, I'd be much more, which of course is true. I mean, that's part of what life extension people are doing. They're not saying, please extend my life, you know, on a respirator. But it does seem like a pro-life attitude, a focus on how can humans live longer, live longer and healthier and happier.
Yeah,
that is kind of cool.
All right. Well, we have a number of questions in the chat going back to some previous topics as well. So why don't I, unless you have any last comments on this topic, I will go and find some more questions for you guys to answer.
Good. Yep.
Right. Let's see. So going back to the inflation question, Kevin Roman on Facebook asks, how much of this is caused, the inflation issue is caused by baseline budgeting?
Oh, Kevin, you know that's way too technical. I would say zero. That's my answer, Kevin. Email me, though, so we can debate this. Zero. Baseline budgeting is a technical public finance issue. I don't think that's related at all.
All right. And now going back to the first discussion we were having, let me see. I'm still scrolling up in the chat here to get to the question. Let's see if I can find it. All right. So David Kelly wants to know, is it possible that college students don't appreciate that it is intended, so we're talking about the free speech issue, that these are intended for discussion and debate, seeing it rather as a social club, college, in which women tend to emphasize empathy, togetherness, don't be rude, quote unquote, et cetera. So to what degree do college students not appreciate the intention?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a hard question. I would say not only college students, but also faculty and administrators.
Yeah.
The question is, what is the core value or the top value of a university? And there are lots of things we want universities to do, including, you know, socialization. We pursue lots of social values and so on, job training, cognitive training, finding the meaning of life, becoming independent from your parents, right, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a long list of things that universities over the course of the 20th century strove to add to the package. And universities came to be these very full service yeah, operations. And that did lead to some slippage in the idea about what exactly of all of these values that we're trying to promote are the top values and which ones are the secondary values as well. Adding to all of that, there are ideological differences. Some people are not that interested in cognition, but they are interested in social engineering. Some people do, in fact, go to university just to get married, and other people, or just to get a job, and they're not really interested in the meaning of life, and so on. So yes, but I would just say that's part of the ongoing mission of the university, is to do self-examination. Why are we here? And to have that conversation going with the faculty and the students and the administration. But then in that mix, my argument is always going to be the pursuit of truth is the ultimate value, and the others should be subordinate to that.
David, it might interest you that a related survey, very interesting, a survey was done a couple of years ago, I think of 15,000 college students. Would you be willing to have a roommate who's the opposite political party of you? What do you think the survey said? Are Republican freshmen more tolerant of their liberal roommate? Answer, yes. And it doesn't go the other way around. The liberal does not really like ending up with a conservative roommate. But now drill down. What do you think the woman Democrat or liberal, even less tolerant? Very interesting, and somewhat dovetails with the essay that Stephen pointed, or the survey Stephen pointed out today. So that's kind of more personal, like who are you willing to be with on campus? Not but just be with, live with. Here's another interesting, just an anecdote. I will often ask students, if you have a minority view, and today that usually means pro-capitalist, pro-American, pro-constitutional, do you get more pushback from professors or students? Because the conservatives will constantly say the professors are terrible, they're punishing kids and they're downgrading them. The answer universally from these students is other students. They do not say professors are punishing them. The conservatives, libertarians, and objectivists are saying other students are ostracizing them, isolating them, denouncing them. Very interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not
quite sure.
Yeah.
Abby, just for one more comment, just piggybacking on what Richard just said, it is interesting in the 1990s on this free speech issue. If you look at all of the speech codes that were being promulgated, all of them were directed at students. They were crafted by professors saying, and almost always explicitly, students are not allowed to discriminate or be intolerant with respect or engage in hate speech with respect to this. So the idea was that the professors or the enlightened ones and the students needed to have the training wheels put in place in order to keep them on track. And then what happened over the course of the next generation is that students learned that lesson very well. And by the time we got into the 20 teens, the table was turned. And all of the high profile cases involved students raising complaints against their professors.
Yes.
And students raising complaints against other student groups, exactly along the lines that Richard is highlighting.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, anecdotally, I would say that was true when I was in university. It was students primarily putting the pressure. Sometimes it felt like professors were even a little bit scared to go against what the students were saying in class. Right. So that I would say anecdotally, I think is true. So as always, this is an amazing conversation. You guys are both not just an economist and a philosopher, but well-versed in other multidisciplinary, I suppose I should say. So very impressed with all that you guys know. I hope to be as knowledgeable someday. So I want to thank you, Richard and Stephen, for joining us. Thank all of you for joining us. Again, I'm Abby Beringer. If you enjoyed this video or are a fan of our other material, please consider making a donation at atlassociety.org/donate. And be sure to tune in next week when Ahmad Massad will be our guest for the next episode of the Atlas Society Asks. And lastly, tomorrow, don't forget Richard's Clubhouse. That was posted in the chat. And we also have Morals and Markets with Richard next Thursday and Atlas Intellectuals on February 9th. So there's very much, you'll get emails about it. Get on our email list if you're not already, to stay up to date on all of our webinars and events. So
thank you, Abby. Thank you, Stephen. Thanks all.